Good morning, everybody. My name is Kevin Upham, and I'm the chairman of Avondale Corporate. And today I'll be talking to you about... Today I will be talking to you about EBITDA and valuations. I'm joined by my co-chair, Tim Hardman, and colleague. He will also be talking about valuation models. Now, for those of you who know Avondale, we help specialise in buying and selling companies. We also do a bit of strategy work. Many of you may have seen the EBITDA model moving around on LinkedIn. Essentially, it was a coffee mug with the joke EBITDA on it, and it stands for EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortisation, and now post-COVID with a COVID model. So we're going to be looking at what that really means for the M&A industry. We've got about 50 minutes today, so we're also going to be having some questions. So please fire in questions as you go. That'll be really helpful as we go along, so there's some participation. Moving on, I mean, the good news is M&A is open for business, and we are finding that people are agreeing deals, but what models are they using, and how do we, as advisors and entrepreneurs, work through those models within the valuation context. Now, to give you some thoughts on the market, what we're actually seeing, obviously COVID's been a dramatic impact for a lot of people. We're actually seeing a slowdown in the economy. And from that perspective, M&A is actually part of the solution. Not the problem, if you like. We think there's too many companies subscale, carrying too much debt, and bringing together businesses actually contributes to the economy and resolves the issue. But within that backdrop, and you'll see here that we've made a graph. Some of you may have seen it before. IMF GDP forecast, and up to between 2010 and 2020, we'd effectively be having slow growth, very, very grinding, and almost flatlining. We're going to see a big drop. And ultimately, that is going to be driven by people's changes in behaviours. And what we need to make sure is that we plug that into our thinking around mergers and acquisitions as well. So there's more debt than ever before to pay for the post-COVID era. And we've got really slow or negative growth. Yet, bizarrely, we're in a world of superabundant capital. So there's more money available to do deals, and people are putting them into bringing companies together. There is a bit of a factory reset. And within that context, we think that ultimately people are going to be more open to conversations. So for us as advisors and entrepreneurs, it means getting into those conversations more quickly and actually more simply to get deals done. So obviously the fundamentals still apply. I mean, we call it the four corners of M&A, and within valuations, the same measure also applies. If you've got all four corners in a target, then you can pay more. So the four corners, we call them, are economies of scale, so that's cost savings, shareholder value, that's about saving money within the shareholders and actually building equity value. So if you can bring together companies at multiples of 6 and 7 and then sell out at multiples of 8 and 9, then you are creating shareholder value. Synergy is the ability to cross-sell. But the one that we most like and actually still feel is the most effective is positive disruption. And that is when you get all the other corners in element, and that then changes the marketplace. And Google, with 187 acquisitions so far, is as you know, is the master of doing that. And so we think that there's an awful lot of energy around creating positive disruption and changing business models through mergers and acquisitions. In terms of the actual specifics of valuations, and so Tim's going to be talking to us today about that. I'm also going to be running some conversation with Tim, some questions, but please fire in your questions as we go. And actually some specifics for me. First point, we think the old rules still apply, but what we're looking at is new models. And the new models, and specifically around the recurring revenue, particularly on recovery and also the speed of recovery post-COVID following the lockdown. People are going to be tracking what are the behavioural changes that we're going to have within different business models as a result of COVID, and therefore sustainability is going to be increasingly at question. And that we've been doing deals on run rate for years now, but we think that that's going to become even more important. As I say, Tim's going to talk about that a bit more in a second. We also think that technology has become more important. I mean, we've already seen this trend of technology, technology within companies, due diligence has been all around commercial and legal in the past. We've seen people now investing more in technology due diligence. We've actually partnered with a firm that does that, if anyone's interested. We think it's particularly important. And again, post-COVID, the whole data protection, home working environments, and all of those areas and productivity within home working are going to become really critical for a lot of more service-orientated businesses, which obviously reflects the UK economy. So we think that that is going to be really, really important. Tax losses, of course, will come into valuations. Obviously, that's only if you're in the same trade. Most valuations, debt-free, cash-free, civil loans have been built up. And we do think that there are going to be companies that are going to be pragmatic about their ability to service those civil loans who will be looking at debt-to-equity swaps. And again, we'll examine a bit more on that later. Most likely deals will be structured to hedge risk, and there will be some more buffers around those risks. We agreed 3 transactions last week. All of them have some form or other of earn-out. So that's, you know, symptomatic of the changes. So, and that's a little bit for me on valuations. So I'm going to be sitting in and listening as chair, but I'd like to pass you over to Tim, who's going to talk to you about some specifics of EBITDAC. Tim, over to you.
Thank you, Kevin, and good morning, everybody. I'd like to start very briefly by looking at sort of valuation methods as... Was I muted there for a second? Was that coming across?
Yeah, we can hear you again, Tim.
Okay, you got me back. Okay. Good. Sorry, I'll start again just in case the whole intro was missed. Really, first thing to do is look at what valuation methods we are going to use. And I'm sure all of you are aware there are numerous out there. I think you can probably see where I'm going with this slide with the highlighted EBITDA times price earnings ratio to give an enterprise value. But very, very briefly, I just want to sort of touch on why I'm not going to cover off the others and why I'm using that as our methodology. I think asset value, brand and IP tend to be used where in distress scenarios or where things are going wrong, profit isn't being generated. Sweat equity, you know, a buyer really doesn't care how much time and effort the seller has been put into developing their business and getting to the position they're in. They care about the future. I think the same applies to level of capital invested, although there are some exceptions to that sort of thing. I also think sector specific, number one, there's too many, so we simply don't have time to go through them all. Number two, you'd be amazed how often a sector-specific valuation model ends up being very, very similar to the EBITDA times PE ratio. So that's where we're going to focus for now. And if you could move on to the next slide, please, Kevin. Okay, so the first thing we need to do is establish what profit figure we are going to be working from. And that involves normalizing the financial statements. And I deliberately use the term normalizing rather than adjusted, which is often used. I feel adjusted can sometimes smack of fiddling almost. So I think normalizing is a better term to use. So first thing to do really is look at the P&L, adjust, normalize, uncommercial shareholders' packages and benefits. With privately owned businesses, it's very, very common for shareholding directors not to be paying themselves the going rate for the roles they're performing, very often tax-driven. I think that's possibly becoming less and less relevant as we go forward, but certainly historically that was a key driver behind it. Where freehold property exists, if it's owned by the business, I would start with the assumption that most investors in businesses are not necessarily interested in investing in freehold property. So they're more likely to want to lease, and you will need to allow for the cost of that. There may be extraordinary items within the P&L. There may be misposted items, or non-GAAP or unusual accounting policies. You know, a classic we see is something that might perhaps be capital expenditure being put through the P&L. So perhaps we should normalize that out, put that into the balance sheet and apply appropriate depreciation policy instead. I think with the balance sheet, you need to effectively go through the same exercise. I'm sure as most people know, businesses are normally sold on what's known as a debt-free, cash-free basis with normalized working capital. So we need to remove non-trading debt. And by non-trading, I mean, you know, financing such as invoice discounting or what have you, rather than normal trading debtor creditors. It may well be there's cash in the business beyond required for normal trading cash flow. I would almost always simply put a line through any intangible fixed assets listed in the balance sheet. You know, typically they're things like around IP and what have you. And we're trying to value that in this process, so we don't want to double account for it and leave it in the balance sheet. And again, same principle as the P&L, any non-GAAP or unusual accounting policies. Sorry, by GAAP, for anybody who doesn't know, I mean generally accepted accounting principles.
Tim, can I just quickly heckle you there? We had a question about my point on buffer on cash flow.
Yep.
Debt-free, cash-free. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you envision that buffer to be actually be applied within the sort of debt-free, cash-free mass?
Well, I think there are two areas potentially. You're probably more likely to have a bun fight about what the working capital requirements are in the final negotiation of a transaction. But there is a secondary thing that protects. You touch on, I think, one or two slides again, I can't remember which one, increasing deal structures by which you're referring to things like earnouts or deferred payments or performance related or something like that. You know, I think that will very often provide the margin for error with greater nervousness around cash requirement or cash buffers, as you put it.
Cool. Okay.
Does that help? Okay. And then the final point on this slide, the enterprise value versus equity value. The enterprise value is the theoretical value for the business as a whole, which we'll come on to in the following slides. The equity value is the cash you get out. And probably the best analogy I can give you this one is if you think about your own house. If you have a house worth £1 million and you've still got £200,000 on the mortgage, yes, the enterprise value of the house is £1 million, but your equity value is 100. The same principle applies with a business. Very often we see the equity value is higher than the enterprise value, and very often with additional cash beyond the working capital requirements. So if you could move me on to the next slide, please, Kevin. Okay, as we're talking about COVID, I'd just like to run through a few statistics with you. And this slide looks back over the last 14, 15 years, and I've deliberately gone back period because it takes in the 08, 09 recession. And that is the only real tangible comparative I think we have in living memory to what we might be facing today. I'll just talk you through this one very quickly. The first thing you'll notice is the orange line, quarterly deal volume, which is UK, by the way. And you'll note, Kevin's head and my head are on my screen above the figures. Yeah, that's what I thought it was. You'll note that pre-recession deal volumes were running at about 1,200. That absolutely crashed going to ESO 9, and we dropped down sub 800 levels. That's a massive, massive difference. And then if I move on, and also I think what's interesting is how long it took to recover. And if you look at the slide, we're actually still not back to those peak levels. The solid blocks represent average price earnings ratios paid. And when you first look at the slide, you'll go, that seems to drop quite severely as well. But I think I would make a couple of points there. At the peak, it was a little bit below 7. The lowest point dropped down to about 5.5. So it's not as severe a drop by any stretch of the imagination as volumes. Also, you'll note how quickly that recovered. But I think there are two factors we should build into this to give this some context. Number one, these figures are based on last full year's earnings. And to preempt one of them I'm going to come on to, high growth businesses tend to be valued higher than low growth businesses. So you have a skew between the run rate of the time of a transaction and the financial information used for publishing statistics. So I think that creates this form of drag. When you come into recession, what you may find is performance of a particular business drops a little bit, and therefore that will artificially reduce the price earnings ratio paid. So if we were to say, I don't know, let's keep the numbers nice and simple for my benefit, but a business with £1 million EBITDA, and let's say that would attract a 6 multiple. And again, please don't quote me on these figures. I'm just keeping the math simple for me. And then the profit drops a little to, 900 odd thousand. You are going to see the price come down, although statistically the figures will show it based on £1 million profit he was making in the last set of accounts pre-deal. So that artificially reduces the price ratio. And then second point I'd like to make on that, if you look at the grey line, which is mega deals. And again, large deals will tend to drive price earnings ratio, and look at how closely the mega deals follow the other two trends. And by mega deals, by the way, we're talking about excess of 20 billion enterprise value. So sort of big stuff, very low volume. And then next slide, please, Gavin. This slide is not intended to be a formula. It's supposed to give an idea of the sort of things that are likely to influence multiple paid upwards or downwards. And it's things like contracted revenue, forecast ability, cash flow, strength of management, reliance on key shareholders or key directors, and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not going to go reading through this entire slide. You'll all get copies of it post-webinar, so you can have a look yourself. But I think you understand the principle, and it's almost like an old school SWOT analysis. So, the more stuff or the more weighted you are to the strengths and opportunities, as opposed to the weaknesses and threats, the higher it's likely to drive the multiple paid. But if you can take me on to the next slide, Kevin, please. I think there is one key driver for multiple, which we see across sectors. And hopefully this brings this to a little bit of conclusion for everybody as well. This is simply scale. This is taken partly from the UK deal statistics you saw a couple of slides back. So the average price earnings ratio being circa 6.5 and being relatively well maintained at that level for a long, long period of time. The average deal size that those statistics are borne out of is circa 11 million, which will take you to an average EBITDA of circa 1.7 million. And you'll see...
Tim, yeah, Kevin. Could you move your phone from a laptop? Because you're cutting in and out. It's a good suggestion from one of our panelists. It's worth a go. Just slightly.
How is that now?
Yeah, I think it's better. So thank you. That was from Martin Woods, a good suggestion. I've already done mine because I noticed it earlier, but yeah, good. So hopefully, keep going.
Good. You've moved me on a slide, Kevin.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go. Right. So I think this gives, this mixture of the statistical average, what we see in our own transactions. There have been surveys done of larger transactions in the 40 million plus, or average of 40 million enterprise value, which starts taking you into 10 plus multiples. And it's not an absolute, it's not a formula, but hopefully this gives everybody a little bit of a guide as to, likelihood and its range of likelihoods that you might expect to see. I think that draws it to a close for me, Kevin.
Okay, Tim, that's very useful. But I do want to ask a question whilst we're still on this slide, Tim, because we're going to sort of move to a bit of a conversation in a second. And that's actually on the sort of lower, very light orange color band. One of our competitors posted the other day that they've agreed a couple of deals post-COVID and all over a multiple of 10, which had us sort of raising our eyebrows. What's your view on that? Because you've got this much lower bar here that's showing stuff well below multiples of five and six.
I think yes, you do, and I mean there are certain businesses where there isn't growth and what have you, but and deals are still done. So in answer to your question, well, point one, I would treat the statistics with a little bit of skepticism unless they are providing supporting data to back that up. So I can't really answer it from that point of view. I think point two, and if you flip back two slides, this effect I was talking about of there being a drag on the EBITDA figure used because it's based on last full year's earnings, and a deal being done today. So it may be they are doing it the other way around and looking at what is fundamentally a good company that's taken a hit in its profits artificially caused by COVID-19, where the expectation is that it will bounce back. And therefore, if you apply the price to the current run rate, it may well drive a very high multiple. It doesn't quite fit in with the way the statistics are produced, though.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Jim. I've got some more questions actually, but guys, please fire in questions as you go. We've had a few, so we'll try and cover those. I think I've also tried to try and cover some live. As you can see, Tim and I very proudly compare ourselves to Waldorf and Stadler, the old guys from the Muppets, for those of you old enough to remember. Their style was deliberately cantankerous and contradictory, which I think pretty much styles Tim and I up in terms of conversation. So, Tim, I think, if you come back.
On that point, Kevin, I should jump in very quickly and just let the audience know that I got an email from Kevin 2 or 3 days ago and say, "Hey, Tim, do you remember the two old blokes from the Muppets who used to yes, I do. What are they called? No idea, Kevin. I didn't know that this was where it was leading at the time."
Right, there you go. But we're even starting to look like them, Tim, so it's a good start. But
Thank you.
I think that I've said to you before, I really don't like the EBITDA model. I really like the SaaS method of valuation that brings in the run rate of growth. I think the EBITDA model allows for that with a sort of weighting in terms of up in the multiple or lowering it depending on growth, but there's no specific formula for it. And actually, for me, growth is the number one point. And in this case, speed of recovery is the number one sort of valuation driver. How do you think we load that into the actual multiple? We've also had a question, how do you actually pick multiples?
Okay, well, if I address the picking multiple question first, it's a judgment call. There is no exact answer, I'm afraid. It is a case of, I mean, I think like any other investment, it's a case of judging risk return. So you are making that judgment call based on, Kevin is championing growth, and I completely agree with that. A growth history is very important, and a future growth story is very important. you know, reliability and forecastability of income are very, very important things. You know, strength of management are very, very important things. But, you know, ultimately it is a judgment call. And if I look at pretty much every transaction we've been involved in, I mean, you know, it's not like the housing market where there might be a 5% variation in offers from the lowest to the highest. You know, you could be looking at 50, 60% variations in the view on value from particular purchasers. And I actually take Kevin back to the four corners of M&A. And if you're actually looking at what will be achieved when two organizations are brought together, and it's particularly through economies of scale, all that tends to be a sort of one hit. Synergies, I think, are very important because that can increase and ramp up. Obviously, by that we mean sort of cross-selling to the customer base or the other party's customer base, new sets of product, et cetera, et cetera. So that can continue to scale. And I think those sorts of things are absolutely key, likely to drive the multiple. But it's to be.
Okay, I think that's a good answer, a useful answer within that. The other question, Tim, I mean, CIBIL loans can be used for M&A, and, you know, but they can't be used for share buybacks. But the answer is, so long as it's in the interest of the business model, according to the, you know, most banks' terms and conditions. I've been cautioning against that because I think, yeah, I think this is going to be a bit of a W shape. I don't think the recession's truly started yet because of the furlough schemes, etc. We're seeing companies with big cash balances, but the impact in terms of their hit on trade hasn't filtered through. Am I being too cautious? What was your view on CIBIL loans for acquisition? I mean, it seems tight.
Case by case is the short answer. You know, you've got to look at, you know, your own cash flow and your own cash flow projections going forward. I was talking to somebody, what is it, roughly 3 months ago, at the beginning of civil loans. They were in a very, very cash-rich position. I can't remember the exact figures, but he reckoned he had sufficient cash being in the business to run him all the way through to the back end of 2021, even allowing for you know, his predicted downturn. But he was still looking at, you know, or considering the idea of whether he'd go down the CIBIL loan route. You know, frankly, it's very, very deep money. And whilst one might argue it's not what it was designed for, we did our research, and yes, you know, you are able to use it for M&A. So if that M&A is for the good of the business and everything else stacks up, yes, perhaps you should look at it. It's, you know, think about it as just another source of finance.
Yeah, I think if you're in a position to personally back the business but don't want to, then the CIBIL loan's perfect as well, because, you know, but you need to allow that buffer before you take the risk in terms of that. So I think that's a good answer. Jim, we had a really good question in, actually. Reminds me of that story. Do you remember that deal where we had to go and get the client out of the pub because he'd taken all the cash out of the bank? Yeah, debt-free, cash-free can be interpreted in a number of ways. Yep. Obviously, you can't do that today because pub's not open, but maybe in the garden for the 4th of July. But the question is, you know, they expect an empty bank account on completion. You've talked about, and I've actually answered one of the questions, taking the average of the normalised aged debtor creditor to get normalised working capital. But yeah, what else do you think people can do on this working capital? Because it's again, with volatility of cash flow and uncertainty, it's going to be really, really a roller coaster of a ride working it out, isn't it?
I think that's true. And I think there are perhaps two things that should be considered or borne in mind with this. I suspect with transactions now and going forwards for a while, the fight over what is the required working capital levels will perhaps be harder fought than it might have been pre-COVID-19. I also think that with the likelihood of an increase in structures, and whether that's simply the volume of deals that have some structures rather than simply being a cash transaction, or whether you mean the proportion of enterprise value that is paid as cash on the table on day one compared to what is stripped, I think that will provide that cash flow buffer we originally talked about. So it could actually provide for some sort of post-completion true-up where the actual cash is known.
Yeah. Okay. That's useful within that. There have been some arguments, and we've actually had a panelist question that relates to this, which is somebody who's been very bullish on the value of their company because they haven't been hit by COVID at all. Yeah. Some arguments, survivor companies, valuations will go up.
Completely agree.
But to me, it seems at all order with the risk against you. Yeah, I mean, I get it because there's less stock, but at the same time, you're ploughing into a headwind now, and every company's doing the same. So, how can that work?
Well, I think, as with all these things, you know, certain sort of caveats or considerations built in. But I would think that if a company has either continue to trade well or grow through, frankly, one of the worst, or the worst health crisis and economic crisis in living memory, I mean, that's got to be about the biggest tick in the box as far as multiple influence is concerned. So I think...
Am I missed that? Sorry, it went a bit crackly. Could you run that last bit?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how far back. So, if a company has thrived or survived and bounced back very well after COVID, I think that is an enormous tick box as far as influence of multiples are concerned. So I would think that in certain circumstances, businesses can command a higher multiple. I do think your rarity point will come into play as well, Kevin. What is the statistic or the estimated $2 trillion of European private equity dry powder out in the market at the beginning of the year? You know, that's looking for a home.
2.4 trillion and, you know, limited yield. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I would throw in a couple of cautionary notes on this one particularly. And I come back to this sort of normalization concept. If you are a buyer stroke investor, be very careful that you don't sort of get carried away too much with the here and now. And if I give a very, very simple example, I'm sure manufacturers of surgical masks are having a wonderful time at the moment and artificially increasing their margins. And I suspect post-COVID, masks will, be used more commonly, but you've got to assume that is going to drop. And even if the volume remains, supply and demand will level itself out. It always does, and therefore you will get a softening of margin for those who artificially increase margin during immediate post-COVID. I would be factoring those sorts of elements into any normalization of the financial statements.
Okay. Thanks for that. Some questions. I'll try and address one, which is, when is a good time to complete a transaction that's come in? I mean, for us, I mean, we are looking at our transactions in November. We think that you will then have a 3-month run rate of the post-COVID lockdown model. So if you like the EBITDAC model, so you can use, I mean, obviously the last 3 years accounts has always been a historic way of valuing companies, but in the real world, nobody can remember what happened 3 years ago. It's what's happening right now, and it's what the forecasts are and what the work in progress is. And so we think that you need really 3 months under your belt of COVID in order to see, the potential recovery run rate to complete transactions. And that's allowing for some deal structure as well to push past the COVID trading. Tim, another question. Given the uncertainty in COVID and the expected bum fights over working capital, do we expect more lockbox calculations? And the deals we agreed last week, well, there's certainly one of those with lockbox. I can't remember on the other two.
That's a really, really good question. One of the issues, in my view, with lockbox is it's, and depending on the duration, of course, is it doesn't allow for growth or contraction. So I think it's a really, really good question. I just think it's too soon to tell. I know historically I have tried to avoid lockbox wherever possible, and probably 95%+ of the time have achieved that. Sometimes have even selected buyers who are running pretty level on how they wish to approach those sorts of issues, those sorts of elements of the transaction. It may well come into play. It's too soon to tell.
Lockbox, of course, is where you peg the balance sheet pre-completion on historic number rather than try and forecast it at completion, which is perhaps the more typical method.
I mean, just to go back to the point I was making, I had a buyer, and I'm going back 3 or 4 years now. Client of mine was quite fast growth. I think their last full year's earnings showed... I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was a little shy of 2 million. I think it was about 1.8 million EBITDA, something like that. We were pretty much year end of the current year, but we didn't have the published figures. And, you know, which was over 2 million. And the run rate was showing maybe we were at 2.5, 2.6. And this buyer was wanting a lockbox mechanism, and to which I'm saying, so sorry, you want us to give you, you know, effectively what will end up being the last 18 months profit. You know, and they were absolutely insistent that that was the model they were working to.
These are the kind of games that I can't see being played and don't want to see being played post-COVID. I think, you know, we wrote that article, M&A without a babelfish, strip out the jargon, get rid of the gameplay, get to the point, be transparent, you can do accelerated deals. We can't afford that kind of gameplay, can we? I think that's typical manipulation of financiers, sorry. I'm being a bit harsh, but the way of doing deals, come on.
Kevin, I agree, but I would come back and say, you know, most of the time, in my experience, you know, where you do have a motivated buyer and seller, where the deal is right for both parties, there is a reasonably collaborative approach to a transaction, albeit each side is going to look to protect themselves.
Yeah, so that trading adage, if you buy something, you've paid too much. If you sold it, you've sold too cheap, isn't it? Yeah, okay. We've had a good question in, and it's our business, so we're biased towards a yes, but we're also lead advisory, best advice, and we prepare companies for sale. So are you, or when would you advise businesses to get ready to go to market? Now for preparation or in 3 to 6 months? And that's providing two strong last 2 years EBITDA. So that's, I think from that question, probably had good performance last 2 or 3 months, not good at all. You know, what's the advice? Should you be selling companies in this backdrop?
I think there's possibly two answers there, and it depends on the question. Is whether you said when should you start preparing?
Yeah.
And when should you actually sell? So if I can address...
There are these two questions there.
Separate questions slightly. My normal standpoint is it's never too soon to start preparing. You know, if you start the preparation process, you will find the cracks, the issues, have the opportunity to deal with them, whatever it may be. It may mean there's perhaps improvements in your reporting that might be required to make due diligence as smooth as possible. So, you know, it's never too early within reason. I think, you know, when is the right time is very individual. To sell that is very individual circumstances dependent. I would say somebody who has been unaffected by COVID and continued with their growth trajectory and what have you, now is an extremely good time. You know, you are the exception rather than the rule. Stand out from the crowd. It may be, you know, by the time, you know, with through planning processes, et cetera, you know, yes, you're going to be going to market in 2-3 months' time, possibly, not tomorrow. But yes, if you are doing well, fantastic. If you've been hit by COVID, but you know your position is reasonably that as lockdown eases, business should return to normal for you. And I have seen plenty of examples of this already. Then yes, I think you made a comment earlier, Kevin, that I can't remember what it was relating to, but you know, possibly you want 2 or 3 months of back to normality starting to show through your P&L before you're getting into proper discussions with purchasers. But we've got, you know, we've got deals that were agreed or being negotiated pre-COVID, where sell side has been very adversely hit. I mean, one to the extent they were down to 25% of revenues. But as lockdown has eased, they have climbed back. They're back up to 75% of revenue already. As the next phase of lockdown eases, we expect that to increase further. We had 3 interested parties. We're in the negotiations with pre-COVID. Not a single one of those 3 has walked away.
I think there's an important backdrop in this as well, though, Tim. I mean, I think, you know, the trade buyers are buying companies to ultimately the good ones to change their business model ahead of the market. So they can see where the threats are coming, and then they're acquiring to build a better business model to offset those threats and build opportunity for their future customer. Private equity are buying because there's too many subscale businesses and they need to be put together. So actually, you know, fundament supply, if you've got a strong business, it's more attractive now, because if you think about it, if you've got significant organic growth, you don't need to do M&A. You don't need to do deals. You're too busy on the organic growth. M&A is quite a good offset activity when you've got drag on economies, as we now have. I mean, my own view is that COVID has just accelerated probably where we were heading anyway, which is a bit like Japan, where we had stagflation, you know, zero growth, zero interest rates, possibly paying for banking, lots of debt creaking around in the background, both governments and companies. In that environment, you've got to pull these businesses together to gain margin and create better businesses. So I think the market's actually poised and very positive. Definitely more buyers than sellers. So, you know, that tells you it's a seller market still.
Well, again, coming back to the condition of the seller's business, but I would agree. I definitely think we will see a reduction in the number of businesses coming to market that far outweighs. I think there will be a small reduction in the number of potential buyers out there. I think some will go, no, it's batten down the hatches time. But I don't think that reduction will be anything like the reduction in the number of sellers. So I think, yeah, you know, quality businesses will sell, and maybe at a, if I was sitting down with somebody thinking about selling their business, I think I'd be nervous about getting too bullish about the potential value over and above normal pre-COVID theories. But that's simply from the point of view of, you know, just taking a pragmatic view. The fact that the hope is there that in negotiation, you know, with multiple bidders, that it might drive the value higher. Yes, that's what you're looking to do. But I think as far as setting expectations are concerned, it's important to be reasonably pragmatic. But, you know, that's kind of always been our approach.
We're getting some great comments in, panelists, so keep going with those comments. They're very useful, and I think, you know, we're all learning from each other. By the way, on that note, if anyone, and certainly our advisor community, if you want, we haven't decided, but we might run a sort of M&A summit where we do an Ask Us Anywhere, Ask Us Anything scenario, and all advisors can get to chip their oar in. I know you'll have the sound of your voices, so do, if you're interested in joining that, email us, because we haven't decided whether we want to do it or not, but we think we might. Tim, last week I agreed a deal with the economies of scale added back. We do that occasionally. What's your view on that? You know, can I rely on that as a seller as a way of boosting my value?
I think the short answer is no. And I'd go a stage further and say I think it can be a little bit dangerous as an opening gambit from a negotiating point of view. It does happen. And I think it happens where a buyer is motivated to want to pay or to acquire and know they need to pay a decent price to be able to do so. My screen's going back. Sorry.
Just changing back, Tim. I can't do tech. It's Waldorf and Statler here. We're old men. We can't do tech, can we? Sorry.
Where was I? Yes. Buyers will need to justify the price paid in some way, shape, or form. A buyer is very rarely an autonomous individual who can simply, do absolutely as they wish without answering to somebody or being questioned by somebody or having raised eyebrows. And whether they choose to get to a price point by saying, yes, we've got £500,000 worth of economies of scale here, or whether they choose to get to a price point by going, actually, this is a fantastic business. We're prepared to pay a higher multiple. I think from sell side, from a negotiating point of view, I would always start with the principle of we are a fantastic business, therefore we think we're worth 7 or 8, not 5 or 6 times, because I think if you start with, oh, but you'll make £500,000 profit more than we will, your buyer is likely to turn around and go, that's fantastic and that's why we're buying you, but we're not paying for that over and above. Equally, it's very, very difficult to prove, because whilst the buyer is in the luxurious position of crawling all over your financial due diligence, you do not have the return opportunity in the negotiation phases.
Yeah, I think as an argument, it works quite well with the smaller companies. I mean, you probably, if you've got contracted revenue, for example, as a sector, you probably don't need an MD and an FD. But, if you're up to 100 people, then you do. So, so it depends on the size of your business model as to an argument. I wouldn't go out to the market specifically going, that's central to how we gain valuation. So we've got lots of questions. We need to sort of start wrapping up now. So I'd like to sort of run some predictions from us in the market off the back of the whole EBITDAC concept.
Don't
heckle me now.
Before you start wrapping up, I'd just like to say to everybody, whilst we may not have time for more questions now, feel free to keep sending them, because historically what we've done is any questions we haven't been able to answer within the session, we've sort of done a Q&A afterwards and sent that out to people. So, please, if you've got more questions, fire them in. We'll do our best to answer them post-webinar.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you. We think that there's going to be an increase in the elevator transactions. So we do think more private equity transactions. We've been seeing that trend anyway. Trade are going to keep going. Our view on trade is increasingly we're seeing more corporate buyers moving into, our traditional space, which is, 3 to 50 million range. We call it the emerging mid-market. Funny enough, I was talking to one of the Barclays Cap guys that do flotations, and they called a mid-market £1 billion. So, just to put that in perspective. But with the emerging mid-market, corporates are moving into really to buy teams, intellectual property, know-how on a low-risk basis. You don't get fired for doing the smaller transactions.
Just to do a final heckle, we had a good question in there. Could you define elevator deals? But bearing in mind that was an expression we coined some 10, 15 years ago, whenever it was, rather than necessarily one that's widely known in the market.
Yeah, so the elevator deal is where, and it typically more with private equity than it is trade, but yeah, effectively where you keep a percentage of the business, take off money off the table now, and then you use that capital to grow, and you're looking at a 3-4 multiple. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. We've got one right now. I don't know where we're going to do it, but the offer's in. Our guy paid £4 million. The current valuation is £5 million. The business has been very slow growth. I mean, it really hasn't moved much since he bought it 3 or 4 years ago. It's a massive marketplace, huge opportunity, but they just don't have the money to put in. So the offer's for £2.5 million. I don't know whether we should take it for half the business, but there's a follow-on capital of that between £2.5 and £10 million. That gives us a war chest to do acquisitions and also new territories. So the debate for us is, do we do an elevator deal? We take a little bit of money off the table now, put some of that money also into the company, and then work out how to go for fivefold growth, or do we just continue with this slow growth? And so elevator deals are where you take in that capital, keep equity, and then see if you can four or fivefold it over the duration. Quite often with a change of management behind it as well. So, and we think that they're you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are going, well, actually, if I can get a de-risk, I like the idea of teamwork against the COVID backdrop. It's going to be hard work out there, and working in teams is a proven method with capital behind you of growing companies. Tim, did I answer that okay?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Okay. Also, I think the other thing we should ignore with the CBIL loan backdrop as well, but I do think the days of the leverage buyout have taken a bit of a blow. We think in particular that's going to hit the management buyout sector. And so we're particularly interested also within the EOT space around, so that's employee ownership deals, more vendor loan driven transactions. And we've got quite a few inquiries in that area. So, you know, there is a feeling that that will occur. I mean, fundamentally, the, you know, the prediction and backdrop, as we've tried to say from the start, we think M&A is the solution. We as advisors and entrepreneurs are going to have to find methods and models past it. We do find it very frustrating. I do spend a lot of time on Excel, and I hate it because actually I like conversations and people, and I think deals are about conversations and people. And I think, you know, it's being pragmatic, using the old rules, applying them in new ways to get a better understanding of that recurring revenue and recovery rates against the forecast is going to be the EBITDAP model. But the other thing we're going to see is, you know, the fundamentals still need to apply. We've got a PLC that we did some work with that was trying to change their business model and move into a new sector. They've been given a value play in their old sector, and they've gone straight for it. And honestly, I really question the acquisition, actually. I mean, you know, their current sector is in decline on a slow attrition basis. Whatever the value play is, don't be distracted. And by fundamentals, what we mean by that is we think that in M&A, consistency pays out. I mean, it's not, for want of a better phrase, it's not the hare and the tortoise that wins. It is the tortoise that wins. It's steady, and it's keeping your strategy in mind, being really clear where you want to get to, sticking to the rules in that, not getting distracted, staying positive and focused on the end goal of that strategy. There are, of course, going to be some leaps of faith. We're all going to have to take them. We do not know how bad this COVID headwind is going to be. It's certainly not pleasant, but we don't know how bad it is. And within that context, to get these better companies, we are going to have to take some leaps of faith around both the model and also the risk in terms of doing deals. But if we stick to the steady fundamentals, so sorry, guys, the steady Eddies will win, you know, do the due diligence, do the technical due diligence, look at the risks carefully. Does it fit your strategy? All of those fundamentals still apply. So we think it's going to be pretty busy out there. Lots of opportunity for everybody. And it is about you know, staying positive and hanging in there to get those right conversations. So we also think it's going to be quite a lot more research work that's going to need to be done to pull in this M&A. I mean, I'll give you an example of that, and Tim, you can sort of back me up on this, but you know, we've got one client we're in negotiation on sweat equity to do their...
I don't know what you're going to say, yeah.
Well, yeah, all right, heckle back, good. But also, you know, we're doing some more acquisition work with a bit more speculation for a few people.
Yes, that very, very true.
Yeah. And that's ultimately because we think if we can bring two or three companies together, then the exit at the end of that makes more sense for people in terms of that transaction. So a lot going on there, guys. Hope it's been useful. Really, as ever, enjoyed itself. Apologies if there is a technical issue in terms of volumes, but hopefully the recording will pick that up better. Sometimes quality is better rather than live. Keep firing the questions. We'll follow up with that. We'll follow up with a slide share, and stay well, everybody.
Thank you.